boat. I'd tear the sky itself down and let the Empire drown in its own blood before she suffers so much as a scratch. He clamped his mouth shut then, jammed the last of his knives into his belt, and began dragging the three broken trees back into position. While he did, Roran rolled the dead soldiers through the trampled mud away from the fortifications. Now I have killed five. At the completion of his labour, he straightened and glanced around, puzzled, for all he heard was silence and the hissing rain. Why has no one come to help us? Wondering what else might have occurred, he returned with Sloane to the scene of the first attack. Two soldiers hung lifelessly on the slick branches of the tree wall, but that was not what held their attention. Horst and the other villagers knelt in a circle around a small body. Roran caught his breath. It was Elmund, son of Delwyn. The 10-year-old boy had been struck in his side by a spear. His parents sat in the mud beside him, their faces as blank as stone. "Something has to be done," thought Roran, dropping to his knees and leaning against his spear. Few children survived their first 5 or 6 years, but to lose your first-born son now, when everything indicated that he should grow tall and strong to take his father's place in Carvajal, it was enough to crush you. Katrina, the children, they all have to be protected. But where? Down the rushing Mirwash. On the first day from Tarnag, Eragon made an effort to learn the names of Undin's guards. They were Armer, Trigger, Hedin, Exvar, Shurdnein, though he was told it meant Wolfheart, Duthmir and Thorv. Each raft had a small cabin in the centre. Eragon preferred to spend his time seated on the edge of the logs, watching the Beor Mountains scroll by. Kingfishers and jackdaws flitted along the clear river, while blue herons stood stilt-like on the marshy bank, which was planked with splotches of light that fell through the boughs of hazel, beech and willow. Occasionally a bullfrog would croak from a bed of ferns. When Oryk settled beside him, Eragon said, "It's beautiful."
"That it is."
The dwarf quietly lit his pipe, then leaned back and puffed. Eragon listened to the creak of wood and rope as Trigger steered the raft with the long paddle at the aft. "Oryk, can you tell me why Brom joined the Varden? I know so little about him. For most of my life, he was just the town storyteller."
"He never joined the Varden. He helped found it."
Oryk paused to tap some ashes into the water.
"After Galbatorix became king, Brom was the only rider still alive outside of the Forsworn."
"But he wasn't a rider, not then. His dragon was killed in the fighting at Doru Areba."
"Well, a rider by training. Brom was the first to organise the friends and allies of the riders who had been forced into exile. It was he who convinced Hrothgar to allow the Varden to live in Fardandur, and he who obtained the elves' assistance."
They were silent for a while. "Why did Brom relinquish the leadership?" asked Eragon. Oryk smiled wryly.
"Perhaps he never wanted it. It was before Hrothgar adopted me, so I saw little of Brom in Trondheim. He was always off fighting the Forsworn, or engaged in one plot or another."
"Your parents are dead?"
"Aye, the pox took them when I was young, and Hrothgar was kind enough to welcome me into his hall, and since he has no children of his own, to make me his heir."
Eragon thought of his helm, marked with the Injitum symbol. "Hrothgar has been kind to me as well." When the afternoon twilight arrived, the dwarves hung a round lantern at each corner of the rafts. The lanterns were red, which Eragon remembered was to preserve night vision. He stood by Arya and studied the lantern's pure, motionless depths. "Do you know how these are made?" he asked. "It was a spell we gave the dwarves long ago. They use it with great skill." Eragon reached up and scratched his chin and cheeks, feeling the patches of stubble that had begun to appear. "Could you teach me more magic while we travel?" She looked at him, her balance perfect on the undulating logs.
It is not my place. A teacher is waiting for you.
Then tell me this, at least, he said. What does the name of my sword mean?
Misery is your sword, and so it was until you wielded it.
Aragorn stared with aversion at Zarok. The more he learned about his weapon, the more malevolent it seemed, as if the blade could cause misfortune of its own free will. Not only did Morzan kill riders with it, but Zarok's very name is evil. If Brom had not given it to him, and if not for the fact that Zarok never dulled and could not be broken, Aragorn would have thrown it into the river at that very moment. Before it grew any darker, Aragorn swam out to Saphira. They flew together for the first time since leaving Trondheim and soared high above the Arj Ragni, where the air was thin and the water below was only a purple streak. Without the saddle, Aragorn gripped Saphira tightly with his knees, feeling her hard scales rub the scars from their first flight. As Saphira tilted to the left, rising on an updraft, he saw three brown specks launch themselves from the mountainside below and ascend rapidly. At first Aragorn took them to be falcons, but as they neared, he realized that the animals were almost 20 feet long, with attenuated tails and leathery wings. In fact, they looked like dragons, though their bodies were smaller, thinner, and more serpentine than Saphira's. Nor did their scales glitter, but were dappled green and brown. Excited, Aragorn pointed them out to Saphira. "Could they be dragons?" he asked.
"I don't know."
She floated in place, inspecting the newcomers as they spiraled around them. The creatures seemed puzzled by Saphira. They darted toward her, only to hiss and swoop overhead at the last moment. Aragorn grinned and reached out with his mind, trying to touch their thoughts. As he did, the three recoiled and shrieked, opening their maws like hungry snakes. Their piercing keen was mental as well as physical. It tore through Aragorn with a savage strength, seeking to incapacitate him. Saphira felt it too. Continuing the racking cry, the creatures attacked with razor claws.
"Hold on!" warned Saphira.
She folded her left wing and spun halfway around, avoiding two of the animals, then flapped quickly, rising above the other. At the same time, Aragorn worked furiously to block the shriek. The instant his mind was clear, he reached for the magic.
"Don't kill them,"
said Saphira.
"I want the experience."
Though the creatures were more agile than Saphira, she had the advantage of bulk and strength. One of the creatures dove at her. She flipped upside down, falling backward, and kicked the animal in the chest. The shriek dropped in intensity as her injured foe retreated. Saphira flared her wings, looping right side up so she faced the other two as they converged on her. She arched her neck. Aragorn heard a deep rumble between her ribs, and then a jet of flame roared from her jaws. A molten blue halo engulfed Saphira's head, flashing through her gem-like scales until she sparkled gloriously and seemed to be lit from within. The two dragon beasts squawked in dismay and veered to either side. The mental assault ceased as they sped away, sinking back toward the mountainside. "You almost threw me off," said Aragorn, loosening his cramped arms from around her neck. She looked at him smugly.
"Almost, but not quite."
"That's true," he laughed. Flushed with the thrill of victory, they returned to the rafts. As Saphira landed amid two great fins of water, Oryk shouted,
"Are you hurt?"
"No," called Aragorn. The icy water whirled around his legs as Saphira swam to the side of the raft. "Were they another race unique to the Beors?" Oryk pulled him onto the raft.
"We call them Fanghur. They're not as intelligent as dragons, and they can't breathe fire, but they are still formidable foes."
"So we discovered." Aragorn massaged his temples in an attempt to alleviate the headache the Fanghur's attack had brought on. "Saphira was more than a match for them, however."
"Of course,"
she said.
"It's how they hunt," explained Oryk. "They use their minds to immobilize their prey while they kill it."
Saphira flicked water at Aragorn with her tail.
"It's a good idea. Maybe I'll try it next time I go hunting."
He nodded. "It could come in handy in a fight, too." Arya came to the edge of the raft.
"I'm glad you did not kill them. Fanghur are rare enough that those three would have been sorely missed.
They still manage to eat enough of our herds, growled Thor from inside the cabin.
The dwarf marched out to Aragorn, champing irritably under the twisted knots of his beard.
Do not fly any more while in these Beor Mountains, Shadeslayer. It is difficult enough to keep you unharmed without you and thine dragon fighting wind vipers.
We'll stay on the ground until we reach the plains, promised Aragorn.
Good.
When they stopped for the night, the dwarves moored the rafts to aspen trees along the mouth of a small stream. Arma started a fire while Aragorn helped Exvar pull Snowfire onto land. They picketed the stallion on a strip of grass. Thorv oversaw the erection of 6 large tents. Hedin gathered firewood to last until morning, and Duthmir carried supplies off the second raft and began making dinner. Arya took up watch on the edge of camp, where she was soon joined by Exvar, Arma, and Triga when they finished their tasks. When Aragorn realized he had nothing to do, he squatted by the fire with Oryk and Shurgnain. As Shurgnain pulled off his gloves and held his scarred hands over the flames, Aragorn noticed that a polished steel stud, perhaps a quarter of an inch long, protruded from each of the dwarf's knuckles, except for on his thumbs. "What are those?" he asked. Shurgnain looked at Oryk and laughed.
"These are mine Askudgamlen, mine fists of steel."
Without standing, he twisted and punched the bole of an aspen, leaving 4 symmetrical holes in the bark. Shurgnain laughed again.
They are good for hitting things, eh?
Aragorn's curiosity and envy were aroused. How are they made? I mean, how are the spikes attached to your hands? Shurgnain hesitated, trying to find the right words.
A healer puts you in a deep sleep so you feel no pain. Then a hole is drilled, yes? Is drilled down through the joint.
He broke off and spoke quickly to Oryk in the dwarf language.
A metal socket is embedded in each hole, explained Oryk. Magic is used to seal it in place, and when the warrior has fully recovered, various sized spikes can be threaded into the sockets.
Yes, see?
Said Shurgnain, grinning. He gripped the stud above his left index finger, carefully twisted it free of his knuckle, and then handed it to Aragorn. Aragorn smiled as he rolled the sharp lump around his palm. I wouldn't mind having fists of steel myself. He returned the stud to Shurgnain.
It's a dangerous operation, warned Oryk. Few Nurlen get Askudgamlen, because you can easily lose the use of your hands if the drill goes too deep.
He raised his fist and showed it to Aragorn.
Our bones are thicker than yours. It might not work for a human.
I'll remember that. Still, Aragorn could not help but imagine what it would be like to fight with Askudgamlen, to be able to strike anything he wanted with impunity, including armoured Urgals. He loved the idea. After eating, Aragorn retired to his tent. The fire provided enough light that he could see the silhouette of Saphira nestled alongside the tent, like a figure cut from black paper and pasted against the canvas wall. Aragorn sat with the blankets pulled over his legs and stared at his lap, drowsy, but unwilling to sleep quite yet. Unbidden, his mind turned to thoughts of home. He wondered how Roran, Horst, and everyone else from Carverhall was doing, and if the weather in Palancar Valley was warm enough for the farmers to start planting their crops. Longing and sadness suddenly gripped Aragorn. He removed a wood bowl from his pack and, taking his waterskin, filled it to the brim with liquid. Then he focused on an image of Roran and whispered, Dramar Kupa. As always, the water went black, before brightening to reveal the object being scryed. Aragorn saw Roran sitting alone in a candlelit bedroom he recognized from Horst's house. Roran must have given up his job in Therensford, realized Aragorn. His cousin leaned on his knees and clasped his hands, staring at the far wall with an expression that Aragorn knew meant Roran was grappling with some difficult problem. Still, Roran seemed well enough, if a bit drawn, which comforted Aragorn. After a minute, he released the magic, ending the spell and clearing the surface of the water. Reassured, Aragorn emptied the bowl, then lay down, pulling the blankets up to his chin. He closed his eyes and sank into the warm dusk that separates consciousness and sleep, where reality bends and sways to the wind of thought, and where creativity blossoms in its freedom from boundaries, and all things are possible. Slumber soon took him. Most of his rest was uneventful, but right before he woke, the usual night phantasms were replaced with a vision as clear and vibrant as any waking experience. He saw a tortured sky, black and crimson with smoke. Crows and eagles swirled high above flights of arrows that arched from one side to another of a great battle. A man sprawled in the clotted mud with a dented helm and bloody mail, his face concealed behind an upthrown arm. An armoured hand entered Aragorn's view. The gauntlet was so near it blotted out half the world with polished steel. Like an inexorable machine, the thumb and last three fingers curled into a fist, leaving the trunk of the index finger to point at the downed man with all the authority of fate itself. The vision still filled Aragorn's mind when he crawled out of the tent. He found Saphira some distance from the camp, gnawing on a furry lump. When he told her what he had seen, she paused in mid-bite, then jerked her neck and swallowed a strip of meat.
"The last time this occurred," she said, "it proved to be a true prediction of events elsewhere. Do you think a battle is in progress in Alagazia?"
He kicked a loose branch.
"I'm not sure.
Brom said that you could only scry people, places, and things that you'd already seen. Yet I've never seen this place. Nor had I seen Arya when I first dreamt about her in Tirm."
"Perhaps Tugira Ikonoka will be able to explain it."
As they prepared to leave, the dwarves seemed much more relaxed now that they were a good distance from Tarnag. When they started poling down the Ajlagni, Exvar, who was steering Snowfire's raft, began chanting in his rough bass.
"Down the rushing mere wash of Kilf's welling blood, we ride the twisting timbers for hearth, clan, and honour. Under the urn's skyvat, through the ice wolves' forest boles, we ride the gory wood for iron, gold, and diamond. Let Handringer and bearded gaper fill my grip, and battle leaf guard my stone, as I leave the halls of my fathers for the empty land beyond."
The other dwarves joined Exvar, slipping into dwarvish as they continued on to other verses. The low throb of their voices accompanied Aragorn as he carefully made his way to the head of the raft, where Arya sat cross-legged.
"I had a vision during my sleep," said Aragorn.
Arya looked at him with interest, and he recounted the images he had seen.
"If it's scrying, then..."
"It's not scrying," said Arya. She spoke with deliberate slowness, as if to prevent any misunderstanding.
"I thought for a long time about how you saw me imprisoned in Gilead, and I believed that as I lay unconscious, my spirit was searching for help, wherever I might find it."
"But why me?" Arya nodded toward where Saphira undulated through the water.
"I grew accustomed to Saphira's presence during the 15 years I guarded her egg. I was reaching out for anything that felt familiar when I touched your dreams."
"Are you really strong enough to contact someone in Tirm from Gilead, especially if you were drugged?" A ghost of a smile touched Arya's lips.
"I could stand on the very gates of Vrongard and still speak with you as clearly as I am now."
She paused.
"If you did not scry me in Tirm, then you could not have scried this new dream. It must be a premonition. They have been known to occur throughout the sentient races, but especially among magic users."
Aragorn clutched the netting around a bundle of supplies as the raft lurched.
"If what I saw will come to pass, then how can we change anything that happens? Do our choices matter? What if I threw myself off the raft right now and drowned?"
"But you won't." Arya dipped her left forefinger in the river and stared at the single drop that clung to her skin like a quivering lens.
"Once, long ago, the elf Mirzadi had a premonition that he would accidentally kill his son in battle. Rather than live to see it happen, he committed suicide, saving his son, and at the same time proving that the future isn't set.
Short of killing yourself, however, you can do little to change your destiny, since you don't know what choices will lead you to the particular point of time that you saw. She flipped her hand, and the drops splattered against the log between them. We know that it's possible to retrieve information from the future. Fortune-tellers can often sense the paths a person's life may take, but we've been unable to refine the process to the point where you can choose what, where, or when you want to see.
Eragon found the entire concept of funneling knowledge through time profoundly disturbing. It raised too many questions about the nature of reality.
Whether fate and destiny really exist, the only thing I can do is enjoy the present and live as honourably as possible. Yet he could not help asking, "What's to stop me, though, from scrying one of my memories? I've seen everything in them, so I should be able to view them with magic."
Arya's gaze darted to meet his.
"If you value your life, never attempt it. Many years ago, several of our spellweavers devoted themselves to defeating time's enigmas. When they tried to summon up the past, they only succeeded in creating a blurred image on their mirror before the spell consumed their energy and killed them. We made no more experiments on the subject. It is argued that the spell would work if more magicians participated, but no one is willing to accept the risk, and the theory remains unproven. Even if one could scry the past, it would be of limited use. And to scry the future, one would have to know exactly what was going to happen, and where, and when, which defeats the purpose. It's a mystery, then, how people can have premonitions while sleeping, how they can do something unconsciously that has defeated our greatest sages. Premonitions may be linked to the very nature and fabric of magic, or they may function in a similar way to the dragon's ancestral memories. We don't know. Many avenues of magic have yet to be explored."
She stood in a single, fluid movement.
"Take care not to lose yourself among them."
Drifting. The valley widened throughout the morning as the raft swept toward a bright gap between two mountains. They reached the opening at midday and found themselves looking out of shadow upon a sunny prairie that faded into the north. Then the current pushed them beyond the frosted crags, and the walls of the world dropped away to reveal a gigantic sky and flat horizon. Almost immediately, the air grew warmer. The Ajragni curved to the east, edging the foothills of the mountain range on one side and the plains on the other. The amount of open space seemed to unsettle the dwarves. They muttered among themselves and glanced longingly at the cavernous rift behind them. Eragon found the sunlight invigorating. It was hard to ever really feel awake when three-quarters of the day was spent in twilight. Behind his raft, Saphira launched herself out of the water and flew up over the prairie until she dwindled to a winking speck in the azure dome above.
"What do you see?" he asked.
"I see vast herds of gazelles to the north and east. To the west, the Hadarak Desert. That is all."
"No one else? No Urgals, slavers, or nomads?"
"We are alone."
That evening, Thorv chose a small cove for their camp. While Duthmir fixed dinner, Eragon cleared a space beside his tent, then drew Zarok and settled into the ready stance Brom had taught him when they first sparred. Eragon knew he was at a disadvantage compared to the elves, and he had no intention of arriving at Ellesmira out of practice. With excruciating slowness, he looped Zarok over his head and brought it back down with both hands, as if to cleave an enemy's helm. He held the pose for a second. Keeping his motion under complete control, he pivoted to the right, twisting Zarok's point to parry an imaginary blow, then stopped with rigid arms. Out of the corner of his eye, Eragon noticed Oryk, Arya, and Thorv watching. He ignored them and focused only on the ruby blade in his hands. He held it as if it were a snake that could writhe out of his grip and bite his arm. Turning again, he commenced a series of forms, flowing from one to another with disciplined ease as he gradually increased his speed. In his mind, he was no longer in the shadowy cove, but surrounded by a knot of ferocious Urgals and Kull. He ducked and slashed, parried, riposted, jumped to the side and stabbed in a whirl of activity. He fought with mindless energy as he had in Farthendur, with no thought for the safety of his own flesh, dashing and tearing aside his imagined enemies. He spun Zarok around in an attempt to flip the hilt from one palm to another, then dropped the sword as a jagged line of pain bisected his back. He staggered and fell. Above him he could hear Arya and the dwarves babbling, but all he saw was a constellation of sparkling red haze like a bloody veil dropped over the world. No sensation existed other than pain. It blotted out thought and reason, leaving only a feral animal that screamed for release. When Aragorn recovered enough to notice his whereabouts, he found that he had been placed inside his tent and wrapped tightly with blankets. Arya sat beside him, while Saphira's head stuck through the entrance flaps.
"Was I out long?" asked Aragorn.
"A while. You slept a little at the end. I tried to draw you from your body into mine and shield you from the pain, but I could do little with you unconscious."
Aragorn nodded and closed his eyes. His entire body throbbed. Taking a deep breath, he looked up at Arya and quietly asked,
"How can I train? How can I fight or use magic? I am a broken vessel."
His face felt heavy with age as he spoke. She answered just as softly,
"You can sit and watch. You can listen. You can read. And you can learn."
Despite her words, he heard a hitch of uncertainty, even fear in her voice. He rolled onto his side to avoid meeting her eyes. It shamed him to appear so helpless before her.
"How did the Shade do this to me?" "I have no answers, Aragorn. I am neither the wisest nor the strongest elf. We all do our best, and you cannot be blamed for it. Perhaps time will heal your wound."
Arya pressed her fingers to his brow and murmured,
"Simoranor ono finna,"
then left the tent. Aragorn sat and winced as his cramped back muscles stretched. He stared at his hands without seeing them.
"I wonder if Murtagh's scar ever pained him like mine does."
"I don't know,"
said Saphira. A dead silence followed. Then,
"I'm afraid."
"Why?"
"Because," he hesitated, "because nothing I do will prevent another attack. I don't know when or where it will happen, but I do know that it's inevitable. So I wait, and every moment I fear that if I lift something too heavy or stretch in the wrong way, the pain will return. My own body has become the enemy."
Saphira hummed deep in her throat.
"I have no answers either. Life is both pain and pleasure. If this is the price you must pay for the hours you enjoy, is it too much?"
"Yes,"
he snapped. He pulled off the blankets and shoved past her, stumbling to the center of the camp where Arya and the dwarves sat around a fire.
"Is there food left?" asked Aragorn.
Duthmir wordlessly filled a bowl and handed it to him. With a deferential expression, Thorv asked,
"Are you better now, Shadeslayer?"
He and the other dwarves seemed awed by what they had seen.
"I'm fine."
"You bear a heavy burden, Shadeslayer."
Aragorn scowled and abruptly walked to the edge of the tents, where he seated himself in darkness. He could sense Saphira nearby, but she left him in peace. He swore under his breath and jabbed Duthmir's stew with dull anger. Just as he took a bite, Oryk said from beside him,
"You should not treat them so."
Aragorn glared at Oryk's shadowed face.
"What?"
"Thorv and his men were sent to protect you and Saphira. They will die for you if need be, and trust their sacred burial to you. You should remember that."
Aragorn bit back a sharp retort and gazed at the black surface of the river, always moving, never stopping, in an attempt to calm his mind.
"You're right. I let my temper get away from me."
Oryk's teeth gleamed in the night as he smiled.
"It's a lesson that every commander must learn. I had it beaten into me by Hrothgar after I threw my boot at a dwarf who left his halberd where someone could step on it."
"Did you hit him?"
"I broke his nose," chuckled Oryk.
Despite himself, Aragorn laughed as well.
"I'll remember not to do that."
He held the bowl with both hands to keep them warm. Aragorn heard the jangle of metal as Oric extracted something from a pouch.
"Here,"
said the dwarf, dropping a knot of intertwined gold rings on Aragorn's palm.
"It's a puzzle we use to test cleverness and dexterity. There are 8 bands. If you arrange them properly, they form a single ring. I've found it useful for distracting myself when I'm troubled."
"Thank you," murmured Aragorn, already entranced by the complexity of the gleaming nest.
"You can keep it if you can put it together."
When he returned to his tent, Aragorn lay on his stomach and inspected the rings in the dim firelight that seeped past the entrance flaps. 4 bands looped through 4 bands. Each was smooth on the bottom half, and an asymmetrical wriggling mass on the top, where it would weave through the other pieces. As Aragorn experimented with various configurations, he quickly became frustrated by a simple fact. It seemed impossible to get the 2 sets of bands parallel, so they would lie flat together. Absorbed by the challenge, he forgot the terror he had just endured. Aragorn woke right before dawn. Scrubbing the sleep from his eyes, he exited the tent and stretched. His breath turned white in the brisk morning air. He nodded to Shrugnine, who was keeping guard by the fire, then strolled to the edge of the river and washed his face, blinking from the shock of the cold water. He located Saphira with a flick of his mind, belted on Zarok, and headed toward her through the beech trees that lined the Ajragni. Before long, Aragorn's hands and face were slick with dew from a tangled wall of chokecherry bushes that obstructed his way. With an effort, he pushed through the net of branches and escaped onto the silent plains. A round hill rose before him. On its crest, like 2 ancient statues, stood Saphira and Arya. They faced east, where a molten glow crept into the sky and burnished the prairie amber. As the clear light struck the 2 figures, Aragorn was reminded of how Saphira had watched the sunrise from his bedpost only a few hours after she hatched. She was like a hawk or falcon, with her hard, sparkling eyes under their bony ridges, the fierce arch of her neck, and the lean strength etched into every line of her body. She was a huntress, and endowed with all the savage beauty that the term implied. Arya's angled features and panther grace perfectly matched the dragon beside her. No discrepancy existed between their demeanours as they stood bathed in dawn's first rays. A tingle of awe and joy shuddered along Aragorn's spine. This was where he belonged as a rider. Of all the things in Alagaesia, he had been lucky enough to be joined with this. The wonder of it brought tears to his eyes and a smile of wild exultation that dispelled all his doubts and fears in a surge of pure emotion. Still smiling, he mounted the hill and took his place by Saphira as they surveyed the new day. Arya looked at him. Aragorn met her gaze, and something lurched within him. He flushed without knowing why, feeling a sudden connection with her, a sense that she understood him better than anyone other than Saphira. His reaction confused him, for no one had affected him in that manner before. Throughout the rest of the day, all Aragorn had to do was think back on that moment to make himself smile and set his insides churning with a mixture of odd sensations he could not identify. He spent most of his time seated against the raft's cabin, working on Oric's ring and watching the changing landscape. Around midday, they passed the mouth of a valley, and another river melded into the Ajragni, doubling its size and speed until the shores were over a mile apart. It was all the dwarves could do to keep the raft from being tossed like flotsam before the inexorable current and to avoid smashing into the trees that occasionally floated by. A mile after the rivers joined, the Ajragni turned north and flowed past a lonely cloud-wreathed peak that stood separate from the main body of the Beor Range, like a gigantic watchtower built to keep vigil over the plains. The dwarves bowed to the peak when they saw it, and Oric told Aragorn,
"There is Muldoon the Proud. He is the last true mountain we shall see on this journey."
When the rafts were moored for the evening, Aragorn saw Oric unwrap a long black box inlaid with mother-of-pearl rubies and curved lines of silver. Oric flicked a clasp, then raised the lid, to reveal an unstrung bow nestled in red velvet. The bow's reflex limbs were ebony, which formed the background for intricate patterns of vines, flowers, animals and runes, all executed in the finest gold. It was such a luxurious weapon, Aragorn wondered how anyone dared use it. Oryk strung the bow. It was nearly as tall as he was, but still no bigger than a child's bow by Aragorn standards, put the box away and said,
"I'm going to find some fresh meat. I'll be back in an hour."
With that, he disappeared into the brush. Thorv grunted disapprovingly, but made no move to stop him. True to his word, Oryk returned with a brace of long-necked geese.
"I found a flock of them perched in a tree," he said,
tossing the birds to Duthmir. As Oryk retrieved the bejeweled case, Aragorn asked, "What kind of wood is your bow made of?"
"Wood?"
Oryk laughed, shaking his head.
"You can't make a bow this short out of wood and cast an arrow more than 20 yards. It breaks or follows the string after a few shots. No, this is an Urgelhorn bow."
Aragorn eyed him suspiciously, sure that the dwarf was trying to fool him. "Horn isn't flexible or springy enough to make a bow."
"Ah-ha-ha," chortled Oryk. "That's because you have to know how to treat it right. We first learned to do it with Feldunost horns, but it works just as well with an Urgel's. It's done by cutting the horn in half lengthwise, then trimming the outside coil until it's the right thickness. The strip is boiled flat and sanded into the final shape before being fixed to the belly of an ash stave with glue made from fish scales and the skin from the roof of trout's mouths. Then the back of the stave is covered with multiple layers of sinew. They give the bow its snap. The last step is decoration. The entire process can take almost a decade."
"I've never heard of a bow built like that before," said Aragorn. It made his own weapon seem no more than a crudely hacked branch. "How far does it shoot?"
"See for yourself," said Oryk.
He let Aragorn take the bow, which he held gingerly, for fear of scuffing its finish. Oryk removed an arrow from his quiver and handed it to him.
"You'll owe me an arrow, though."
Aragorn fit shaft to string, aimed over the Ajragni, and pulled back. The bow's draw length was less than 2 feet, but he was surprised to find that its weight far exceeded that of his own bow. He was barely strong enough to hold the string. He released the arrow and it vanished with a twang, only to reappear far above the river. Aragorn watched with amazement as the arrow landed in a spray of water halfway across the Ajragni. He immediately reached through the barrier in his mind, so that the magic's power suffused him, and said, "Gath Semoro un lam yet." After a few seconds, the arrow darted back through the air to land on his outstretched palm. "And there," he said, "is the arrow I owe you." Oryk clapped his fist to his chest and then embraced the arrow and bow with obvious delight.
"Wonderful! Now I still have an even 2 dozen. Otherwise, I would have had to wait until Hedarth to replenish my stock."
He deftly unstrung the bow and stored it away, wrapping the case in soft rags to protect it. Aragorn saw Arya watching. He asked her, "Do elves use horn bows as well? You're so strong, a wood bow would shatter if it was made heavy enough for you." "We sing our bows from trees that do not grow." And then she walked away. For days they drifted through fields of spring grass, while the Beor Mountains faded into a hazy white wall behind them. The banks were often covered with vast herds of gazelles and small red deer that watched them with liquid eyes. Now that the Fangor were no longer a threat, Aragorn flew almost constantly with Saphira. It was their first opportunity since before Gilead to spend so much time together in the air, and they took full advantage of it. Also, Aragorn welcomed the chance to escape the cramped deck of the raft, where he felt awkward and unsettled, with Arya so near. Arya Svitkona. Aragorn and his company followed the Ajragni until it joined the Edda River, which then drifted into the unknown east. At the juncture between the rivers, they visited the dwarves' trading outpost, Hedirth, and exchanged their rafts for donkeys. Dwarves never used horses on account of their size. Arya refused the steed offered to her, saying, "I will not return to the land of my ancestors on the back of a donkey." Thorv frowned.
"How will you keep pace with us?"
"I will run." And run she did, outstripping Snowfire and the donkeys, only to sit waiting for them at the next hill or copse. Despite her exertions, she displayed no sign of weariness when they stopped for the night, nor any inclination to utter more than a few words between breakfast and supper. With every step, she seemed to grow tenser. From Hedirth, they trekked north, going up the Edda River toward its point of origin at Eldor Lake. Duweldenvarden came into view within 3 days. The forest first appeared as a hazy ridge on the horizon, then quickly expanded into an emerald sea of ancient oaks, beeches and maples. From Saphira's back, Aragorn saw that the woods reached unbroken to the horizon, both north and west, and he knew they extended far beyond that, stretching the entire length of Alagazia. To him, the shadows underneath the trees' arching boughs seemed mysterious and enticing, as well as dangerous, for there lived the elves. Hidden somewhere in the dappled heart of Duweldenvarden lay Ellesmira, where he would complete his training, as well as Ossilon and other elven cities few outsiders had visited since the fall of the Riders. The forest was a perilous place for mortals, Aragorn felt, certain to be riddled with strange magic and stranger creatures. "It's like another world," he observed. A pair of butterflies spiraled around each other as they rose from the dark interior of the forest.
"I hope," said Saphira, "there will be room for me within the trees on whatever path the elves use. I cannot fly the whole time."
"I'm sure they found ways to accommodate dragons during the time of the Riders." That night, just as Aragorn was about to seek his blankets, Arya appeared by his shoulder, like a spirit materializing out of the air. Her stealth made him jump. He could never understand how she moved so quietly. Before he could ask her what she wanted, her mind touched his and she said, "Follow me as silently as you can." The contact surprised him as much as the request. They had shared thoughts during the flight to Farthen Dûr. It had been the only way Aragorn could speak to her through her self-induced coma. But since Arya's recovery, he had made no attempt to touch her mind again. It was a profoundly personal experience. Whenever he reached out to another person's consciousness, it felt as if a facet of his bare soul rubbed against theirs. It seemed boorish and rude to initiate something so private without an invitation, as well as a betrayal of Arya's trust, slender as it was. Also, Aragorn was afraid that such a link would reveal his new and confused feelings for Arya, and he had no desire to be ridiculed for them. He accompanied her as she slipped out from the ring of tents, carefully evaded Trigger, who had taken the first watch, and passed beyond the dwarves' hearing. Within him, Saphira kept a close watch on his progress, ready to leap to his side if need be. Arya squatted on a moss-eaten log and wrapped her arms around her knees without looking at him. "There are things you must know before we reach Ceres and Ellesmira, so that you do not shame yourself or me through your ignorance."
"Such as?"
He crouched opposite her, curious. Arya hesitated.
"During my years as Islanzadi's ambassador, it was my observation that humans and dwarfs are quite similar. You share many of the same beliefs and passions. More than one human has lived comfortably among the dwarves because he or she can understand their culture as they understand yours. You both love, lust, hate, fight and create in much the same manner. Your friendship with Oryk and your acceptance into Durgrim's Tingitum are examples of this."
Aragorn nodded, though their differences seemed greater to him than that.
"Elves, though, are not like other races."
"You speak as though you weren't one," he said, echoing her words from Farthen Dûr.
"I have lived with the Varden for enough years to become accustomed to their traditions," replied Arya in a brittle tone.
"Ah!"
So then, do you mean to say that elves don't have the same emotions as dwarves and humans? I find that hard to believe. All living things have the same basic needs and desires.
That is not what I mean to say.
Aragorn recoiled, then frowned and studied her. It was unusual for her to be so brusque. Arya closed her eyes and placed her fingers on her temples, taking a long breath.
Because elves live for so many years, we consider courtesy to be the highest social virtue. You cannot afford to give offence when a grudge can be held for decades or centuries. Courtesy is the only way to prevent such hostility from accumulating. It doesn't always succeed, but we adhere to our rituals rigorously, for they protect us from extremes. Nor are elves fecund, so it is vital that we avoid conflict among ourselves. If we shared the same rate of crime as you or the dwarves, we would soon be extinct. There is a proper way to greet the sentinels in Ceres, certain patterns and forms that you must observe when presented to Queen Islanzadi, and 100 different manners in which to greet those around you, if it's not better to just remain quiet. With all your customs, Aragorn risked saying, it seems as though you've only made it easier to offend people. A smile flickered across her lips. Perhaps.
You know as well as I that you will be judged by the highest standards. If you make a mistake, the elves will think you did it on purpose. And only harm will come if they discover it was born of ignorance. Far better to be thought rude and capable than rude and incapable, else you risk being manipulated like the serpent in a match of runes. Our politics move in cycles that are both subtle and lengthy. What you see or hear of an elf one day may only be a slight move in a strategy that reaches back millennia, and may have no bearing on how that elf will behave tomorrow. It is a game that we all play, but few control, a game that you are about to enter. Now perhaps you realize why I say elves are not like other races. The dwarves are also long-lived, yet they are more prolific than us, and do not share our restraint or our taste for intrigue. And humans... She let her voice fade into a tactful silence.
Humans, said Aragorn, do the best they can with what they are given.
Even so.
Why don't you tell Oric all this as well? He'll be staying in Ellesmere, same as me.
An edge crept into Arya's voice.
He is already somewhat familiar with our etiquette. However, as a rider you would do well to appear better educated than him.
Aragorn accepted her rebuke without protest.
What must I learn?
So Arya began to tutor him, and through him Saphira in the niceties of elven society. First she explained that when one elf meets another, they stop and touch their first two fingers to their lips to indicate that we shall not distort the truth during our conversation. This is followed by the phrase, Atra esterni onothelduin, to which one replies, Atra du evarinja onovalda.
And, said Arya, if you are being especially formal, a third response is made, Uninhjarta onr, which means, and may peace live in your heart. These lines were adopted from a blessing that was made by a dragon when our pact with them was finalized. It goes, Atra esterni onothelduin, moranar lifa uninhjarta onar, undu evarinja onovarda. Or, may good fortune rule over you, peace live in your heart, and the stars watch over you.
How do you know who is supposed to speak first?
If you greet someone with greater status than yourself, or if you wish to honour a subordinate, then speak first. If you greet someone with less status than yourself, speak last. But if you are uncertain of your position, give your counterpart a chance to speak, and if they are silent, speak first. Such is the rule.
Does it apply to me as well?
Asked Saphira. Arya plucked a dry leaf from the ground and crumpled it between her fingers. Behind her, the camp faded into shadow as the dwarves banked the fire, dampening the flames with a layer of dirt so that the coals and embers would survive until morning. As a dragon, none are higher than you in our culture. Not even the queen would claim authority over you. You may do and say as you wish. We do not expect dragons to be bound by our laws."
Next she showed Aragorn how to twist his right hand and place it over his sternum in a curious gesture.
"This," she said, "you will use when you meet Islandzadi. By it you indicate that you offer her your loyalty and obedience."
"Is it binding, like my oath of fealty to Naswada?"
"No, only a courtesy, and a small one at that."
Aragorn struggled to remember the sundry modes of address that Arya instructed them in. The salutations varied from man to woman, adults to children, boys to girls, as well as by rank and prestige. It was a daunting list, but one that Aragorn knew he had to memorize perfectly. When he had absorbed all he could, Arya stood and dusted her hands.
"So long as you do not forget, you'll do well enough."
She turned to leave.
"Wait," said Aragorn.
He reached out to stop her, then snatched back his hand before she noticed his presumption. She looked over her shoulder with a query in her dark eyes, and his stomach clenched as he tried to find a way to voice his thoughts. Despite his best efforts, he ended up just saying,
"Are you well, Arya? You've seemed distracted and out of sorts ever since we left Hedoth."
As Arya's face hardened into a blank mask, he winced inwardly, knowing that he had chosen the wrong approach, although he could not fathom why the question should offend her.
"When we are in Duwelden, Varden," she informed him, "I expect that you will not speak to me in such a familiar way, unless you wish to cause affront."
She stalked away.
"Run after her!" exclaimed Saphira.
"What?
We can't afford to have her angry with you. Go apologize."
His pride rebelled.
"No, it's her fault, not mine."
"Go apologize, Aragorn, or I'll fill your tent with carrion."
It was no idle threat.
"How?"
Saphira thought for a second, then told him what to do. Without arguing, he jumped to his feet and darted in front of Arya, forcing her to stop. She regarded him with a haughty expression. He touched his fingers to his lips and said,
"Arya Svitkona," using the honorific he had just learned for a woman of great wisdom. "I spoke badly, and for that I cry your pardon. Saphira and I were concerned for your welfare. After all you've done for us, it seemed the least we could do was to offer our help in return, if you need it."
Finally, Arya relented and said,
"Your concern is appreciated, and I too spoke badly."
She looked down. In the dark, the outline of her limbs and torso was painfully rigid.
"You ask what troubles me, Aragorn. Do you truly wish to know? Then I will tell you."
Her voice was as soft as thistledown floating on the wind.
"I am afraid."
Dumbfounded, Aragorn made no response, and she stepped past, leaving him alone in the night.
Ceres.
On the morning of the fourth day, when Aragorn rode alongside Srdnain, the dwarf said,
"So tell me, do men really have 10 toes, as is said? For truly I have never travelled beyond our borders before."
"Of course we have 10 toes, said Aragorn, astonished. He shifted in Snowfire's saddle, lifted his foot, removed his right boot and sock, and wiggled his toes under Srdnain's amazed eyes.
"Don't you?"
Srdnain shook his head.
"Nay, we have 7 on each foot. It is how Helsfog made us. 5 is too few, and 6 is the wrong number. But 7 is just right."
He glanced at Aragorn's foot again, then spurred his donkey ahead and began speaking animatedly to Arma and Eden, who eventually handed him 7 silver coins.
"I think," said Aragorn as he pulled the boot back on, "that I was just the source of a bet."
For some reason, Saphira found that immensely amusing. As dusk fell and the full moon rose, the Edda River drew ever closer to the fringe of Duweldenvarden. They rode down a narrow trail through tangled dogwood and rosebushes in full bloom, which filled the evening air with the flowers' warm scent. Eager anticipation swelled within Aragorn as he gazed into the dark forest, knowing they had already entered the elves' domain and were close to Ceres. He leaned forward in Snowfire's saddle, the reins pulled tight between his hands. Saphira's excitement was as great as his own. She ranged overhead, flicking her tail back and forth with impatience. Aragorn felt as if they had wandered into a dream. "It doesn't seem real," he said.
"Aye, here the legends of old still bestride the earth."
At last they came upon a small meadow set between the river and forest.
"Stop here," said Arya in a low voice. She walked forward until she stood alone in the midst of the lush grass, then cried in the ancient language, "Come forth, my brethren! You have nothing to fear! 'Tis I, Arya of Ellesmere! My companions are friends and allies. They mean us no harm." She added other words as well, ones alien to Aragorn. For several minutes the only sound was the river rushing behind them, until from underneath the still leaves came a line of elvish, so quick and fleeting that Aragorn missed the meaning. Arya responded,
"I do."
With a rustle, two elves stood on the edge of the forest, and two ran lightly out on the boughs of a gnarled oak. Those on the ground bore long spears with white blades, while the others held bows. All were garbed in tunics the colour of moss and bark, underneath flowing cloaks clasped at the shoulder with ivory brooches. One had tresses as black as Arya's, three had hair like starlight. The elves dropped from the trees and embraced Arya, laughing in their clear, pure voices. They joined hands and danced in a circle around her like children, singing merrily as they spun through the grass. Aragorn watched in amazement. Arya had never given him reason to suspect that elves liked to, or even could, laugh. It was a wondrous sound, like flutes and harps trilling with delight at their own music. He wished that he could listen to it forever. Then Saphira drifted over the river and settled beside Aragorn. At her approach, the elves cried out in alarm and aimed their weapons toward her. Arya spoke quickly in soothing tones, motioning first at Saphira, then at Aragorn. When she paused for breath, Aragorn drew back the glove on his right hand, tilted his palm so that the Gedwe Ygdasia caught the moonlight, and said, as he once had to Arya so long ago, "Eka frike un shortagal. I am a rider and friend." Remembering his lesson from yesterday, he touched his lips, adding, "Atra esterni onothelduin." The elves lowered their weapons as their angled faces lit up with radiant joy. They pressed their forefingers to their lips and bowed to Saphira and him, murmuring their reply in the ancient language. Then they rose, pointed at the dwarves, and laughed as if at a hidden joke. Drifting back into the forest, they waved their hands and called, "Come, come!" Aragorn followed Arya with Saphira and the dwarves, who were grumbling among themselves. As they passed between the trees, the canopy overhead plunged them into velvet darkness, except where fragments of moonlight gleamed through chinks in the shell of overlapping leaves. Aragorn could hear the elves whispering and laughing all around, though he could not see them. Occasionally they would call directions when he or the dwarves blundered. Ahead a fire glowed through the trees, sending shadows racing like sprites across the leafy ground. As Aragorn entered the radius of light, he saw three small huts clustered together around the base of a large oak. High in the tree was a roofed platform, where a watchman could observe the river and forest. A pole had been lashed between two of the huts. From it hung bundles of drying plants. The four elves vanished into the huts, then returned with their arms piled high with fruits and vegetables, but no meat, and began preparing a meal for their guests. They hummed as they worked, flitting from one tune to another as the fancy took them. When Oric asked their names, the dark-haired elf pointed to himself and said, "I am Lithain of House Rilvenar, and my companions are Edurna, Seldin, and Nari." Aragorn sat beside Saphira, happy for an opportunity to rest and to watch the elves. Though all four were male, their faces resembled Arya's, with delicate lips, thin noses, and large, slanted eyes that